In these evenings, during the summer period, we've been looking at the Ten Commandments, and we reach this evening number 8. And if you'd like to turn it up, we're following the table in Exodus chapter 20, which is on page 65 of the Old Testament sections of the Church Bibles. Exodus chapter 20 and verse 15, the 8th commandment, "You shall not steal." It comes in a series of short, pithy commandments, all devoted to protecting some aspect of the life of the community. So far, we've looked at respect for mother and father, respect for human life, respect for marriage, and now, respect for property. You shall not steal. Now, maybe as we've gone through these commandments, you've thought, well, you shall not kill, you shall not commit adultery. At least in the letter of the law, I've not broken that one. But when we come to you shall not steal, my guess is, and it can be no more than a guess, that there are very few of us that haven't transgressed this commandment, even in the letter, let alone in the spirit. When it comes to stealing, I suspect all of us are guilty in smaller or greater measure. And maybe you can honestly lay your hand on your heart and say that you've never broken this commandment. I'd like to think that was true of me, but it isn't. Perhaps when we stole, we didn't call it stealing or theft, but nonetheless, stealing and theft is what it was. And this commandment comes as a challenge to the strictest honesty to me, and I hope it comes as a challenge about strict honesty to you as well. I want to divide what I've got to say into two sections, and the second sort of carries the weight of the practical application. The two sections are called property and ownership, and then secondly, property and theft. First of all, property and ownership. There are two extremes of thinking about property. On one hand, there's the view which I suppose is the view of the anarchist who says all property is theft. And owning anything as an individual is a restriction of people's freedom and therefore can be regarded as theft. All property is theft, so nobody has any property. That's one extreme. The other extreme is that of what one might call the acquisitive materialist. Acquisitive, not inquisitive. Acquisitive materialist. He has no concern about anything apart from the possessions he gets. Doesn't matter how he gets them, the people he walks over on the way, the most important thing is getting them. And those are the two extremes. Of course, there's a whole gradation in between. But of course, neither extreme, and most of the positions in between as well, cannot be held by the Christian. Now, on one hand, the Bible nowhere declares that property and ownership of property is wrong or evil. But on the other hand, neither does it condone amassing wealth selfishly without any concern for other people. Property is neither a sin, nor is it an unalienable right. The Bible clearly points to the view that all property is held by its, quotes, owner, as a trust from God himself, what is termed stewardship. Theft, therefore, is stealing what God has entrusted to another person, stealing from him in a way which you could say was stealing from God himself. It's removing from one person the trust which God has given him and usurping it. That leads me into my first subsection, as it were, of property and ownership, and that is to talk about privilege in ownership. Because if all that we have is loaned to us from God, then that's an immense privilege. It's not something that we've any right to boast about. But running alongside this privilege in ownership is what I've called responsibility in ownership, secondly. And this is where those two extremes I mentioned earlier, and indeed many of the intermediate positions, fall down. On one hand, if you reject any notion of owning property, then also you reject any sense of personal responsibility for property. Let me give you an example. When I was in Oxford, there was a scheme set up by the anarchists in the university to free bikes from private ownership. What they did was to take broken down bikes, paint them white, and say that they didn't belong to anybody, they were for anybody to ride. So if you came out of a college and found a white bike, you could ride it to the labs and leave it there, and somebody else would ride it somewhere else, and so on. It sounds a marvellous scheme, until it gets a puncture. Because it doesn't belong to anybody, nobody will mend the puncture. Now, you cannot say that that will work, let alone is biblical. On the other hand, at the other extreme, many who are well provided with this world's goods see no priority to use them for the benefit of others, or even to care whether the other people are trodden on as they get those things for themselves. The Christian view, stewardship of God's property, brings a right sense of responsibility into the way that we use our possessions. We acknowledge them for what they are, and use them accordingly. Privilege and responsibility. But then there's a third area I want to mention under property and ownership, and that is what I've called motives in ownership. Because I think of this great divide which I've described between these two extremes, I guess most Christians would verge this way, towards materialism rather than anarchy. And it's worth examining our own attitudes to what we possess and our motives in the way we acquire them and in the way we use them. St. Paul, in his letter to the Ephesians, says this: "Let the thief no longer steal, but rather let him labor, doing honest work with his hands, so that he may be able to give to those in need." Why should he work? Does it say, let him labor with his own hands that he might feather his nest? No. It says, so that he may be of service to those less fortunate than himself, those who can't work, those who are poor, those who are needy. That is the biblical view. The Bible would not have Robin Hood a hero. Robbing the rich to help the poor is not a Christian option. What is a Christian option is changing society so that the rich acknowledge their responsibility and how they get their riches, in how they use their riches, and in their motives. That's a Christian option. Another Christian option is out of your abundance to give to the needy. That's the Christian option. Theft is always theft, whether it's done by Robin Hood or anyone else. Whatever the motive we have, whatever the reason, whatever name we may dress it up with, theft is theft. So our motive then in ownership should be to be a faithful and a just steward of the property that God has put in our trust. Now by now you might be saying, well, why all this? He's supposed to be talking about not stealing. Why have we gone back to look at property? The reason is simply this. I think it's important because it casts the sin of stealing into perspective. You see why theft is a sin against God when you realize that all property is held in trust from God. When I steal from men, I steal from God because it's all His. When I steal from men, I take away from them a trust which God has given to them. I have no claims even on what is mine, quotes, let alone that which He has not allowed to me. So now we come to my second main section, property and theft. Theft, then, is the denying of a person to their rightful stewardship of God's gifts to them. And I see several faces to theft. The first is what I've called theft's unacceptable face. You see, there's almost universal condemnation in society for armed robbery, for kidnapping, for mugging old ladies with their handbags, for the teams of pickpockets that work Oxford Street, for the thieves who break into private homes and steal and take anything that's saleable, for the car thief, for the confidence trickster who parts people from their money on the doorstep, and so on and so on. Nobody has a good word for them. This is the unacceptable face of theft in society. We don't like it, society at large condemns it, and we're appalled when we're the victims of it, or our friends and relatives are. And rightly so, because God's law is violated and people are harmed. But so often our understanding of God's law ceases at that point and isn't applied to the whole area of human activity, and particularly the whole area of our activity. Activity which is nonetheless theft, but doesn't come under the same general social condemnation of the things I've already mentioned. So we move from theft's unacceptable face to theft's respectable face. Respectable theft is often middle-class theft. It's directed not so much against the individual as against organisations, and particularly against the government. You see, we find it much harder to condemn the person who misleads the income tax inspector than we do the person who steals a wallet from a shopper. We find it much more difficult to condemn the person who claims more than is strictly expenses on his expense account than we do the housebreaker. And part of the reason I suspect why there is this respectable face of theft is that it's not to do with the individual, that somehow it's all right to take from an organisation or the government. It's them. But as Christians, of course, we are tarred often with the same brush as the world is tarred with. We think it's awful to steal from an individual, but the government or the firm is fair game. And that's the way the world thinks, the way the world functions, and we get washed in it as we go about our daily work. And I believe that we need to look to ourselves and to look to our behaviour and check our honesty in business, our honesty in our personal finances, our honesty in our dealings with other people, against the no-compromise ethic that the Bible lays down. Let's make this concrete with some practical examples. Listen to this recent article, or part of a recent article. Precise statistics are impossible to obtain, since no one knows the amount of income that escapes taxation through downright evasion, moonlighting, unrecorded financial transactions, and other similar activities. Inland Revenue officials estimate that the amount is between £5,000 million and £11,000 million a year. A staggering sum, even if the lower one is correct. That's an incredible amount of money. I don't know if you can get your mind round £5,000 million. I can't. But that's the amount of money that the income tax reckon is fiddled every year. Stolen, that is. Someone has calculated that income tax could be cut, basic rate, from 30% to 25% tomorrow if that wasn't fiddled. And the point is not that income tax could be cut, of course not. The point is that people are stealing that amount of money. However nice it would be to have income tax cut, the point is, from a biblical point of view, that there's that amount of theft taking place. Now, as Christians, we need to be scrupulously honest about the way we do our dealings with big organisations, and particularly with the government. We must make sure, for God's sake, that our earnings are declared, all of them, on our income tax return. That we remember the fees that we've received, which are outside our normal PAYE or whatever. That any expenses we claim against tax aren't already being claimed from your employer. As I prepared this, I remembered the verse, "Let him who thinks that he stand take heed lest he fall." And I looked through my own financial things, and I confess I found that I'd done some tutoring, which I had not declared to the Inland Revenue. Now, okay, it's only a few pounds because I don't do much tutoring. And most people say, but why bother? It's only a few pounds. But theft is taking something that belongs to somebody else rightly. And however we dress it up, whether we call it fiddling or however we dress it up, or whether we don't like anyway what the government does with our money, that's not the point. It's still theft. In my reading for this sermon, I came across this delightful quotation in an old commentary. I'm sure it's just as true today. "Many a prosperous gentleman says solemnly every Sunday of his life, 'Incline our hearts to keep this law.' They would have to live in much more modest style if their prayers were, by an unfortunate accident, answered." I rather like that. So as Christians then, we need to be guilty only of meticulous honesty. Otherwise, we're hypocrites before God and bad witnesses before men. The same must be true not only to do with income tax, but over our expenses claim and our use of the company property and company business and so on. I've frankly been horrified by some Christians who said, quite without shame, and I suspect even without noticing that they were saying it, "Oh, it doesn't matter, the firm's paying." I quite regularly get letters from Christians which are in company envelopes, and even on occasions franked by company stamp franking machines. Now, I don't know. Maybe there's a way that people can put their private mail through and pay for it, but I doubt it. Maybe the envelopes were rescued from the waste paper basket, but I doubt it. I honestly don't think that's the way Christians ought to go on. It seems to me that if we're in business to influence the world for Christ, then we shouldn't allow the world to influence us with the way it carries on. My wife also does some examination marking, and she, I ought to tell you quickly, doesn't pay tax because she didn't earn that much. So she's in the clear on this one. I'm not going to tell you a horror story about her. What I am going to tell you is a horror story about some people she met on the way to an examination meeting, because they all met up at the station and took a taxi from the station to the place where the meeting was going to be. And it was quite obvious that everybody was going to put the full taxi fare down on their expenses claim. You might say to me, of course, everybody does it. But why does everybody do it? The answer is, everybody's a thief, that's why. We must, as Christians, stand out against that sort of thing. Otherwise, we don't deserve the name of Christian. Now, I know that's going to be difficult in your place of work. You're going to be unpopular. If you turn in an expenses claim that is consistently below those of your colleagues, it's going to be jolly embarrassing for you. And it might be jolly embarrassing for the higher echelons in the company who have to process it as well. It'll make you jolly unpopular, because it challenges a whole way of life. Men love darkness rather than light, says the Bible, because their deeds are evil. And if you come like a light in darkness and start being different from other people, then they don't like you. We're called, though, to be lights in the dark places of the world, not where it's bright already, in the dark places of the world. And if you stir up a hornet's nest because you're honest and expose corruption and theft, then that is what Christ has called you to. I think sometimes Christians allow themselves to become deaf to their conscience because of all the hassle that would result if they followed what they believed deep down. But surely we must fight. We must fight to hear God's voice through our conscience and to uphold his standards, even if it does prove inconvenient. Of course, it's honesty in the little things as well as in the big. Sometimes when I pick my mail up, I sign my letters here instead of taking them home to sign, and so use the stamps from the office to post them. And it's a real nuisance to have to remember how many stamps I've used on church business and how many stamps actually are on my own private correspondence, so I get the balance right. You might think it's silly to worry about a few pence for a few stamps, but isn't that what we're called to? The Eighth Commandment doesn't say you shall not steal more than a pound at a time. It says you shall not steal. We've already noted the way that we make it legitimate by giving it another name. Fiddling's the thing we've had already. But that's also true in other areas. I was pleased to see in the shop that we habitually use, mentioning no names, for our shopping month by month, to see that they changed their notice, which used to say shoplifters will be prosecuted, to thieves will be prosecuted. I think that's a step in the right direction. Calling a thief, I think, makes some people think twice about what they're doing. But of course, in these days of open shops, where things are available freely, the temptation is very strong. And not just for the theft point of view, but because there's a sort of thrill about not getting caught and so on. It's the same sort of thing as coming through the customs with that extra bottle of wine. But whatever it is, it's stealing. And it breaks the Eighth Commandment. There's just one more way I want to mention in this respectable face of theft before we move on, and that is the theft of time. I trust it's not your attitude to your work that you get as much as possible money for as little possible work, because that too is theft. Sometimes if I cycle through the West End on my way to visit someone or to an appointment or something, in the early afternoon, I see along these cafes here people eating their lunch right into the afternoon, lingering over their lunches, and sometimes I wonder when any of them work. Now, I expect the answer, of course, is that they're, quote, working lunches. And maybe there is a legitimate place for that. But look to yourself. Are you thieving time that is, by right, your employer's, because you're contracted to him? I trust not, but it's very, very easy to do. I remember one job I had when I was a student, and I worked in a paper factory, and we were pushing barrows loaded with paper from the factory to a railway truck. And they were particularly busy in the summer with all the Christmas stuff, you know how it is, and they took on all these students during the summer to catch up with this backlog. And the regulars, had a particular way of walking, a particular way which was a slow way, but it didn't look as though you were going slowly, of pushing the barrow, so you did fewer trips. And they would say to you, don't rush around, you'll tire yourself out. But of course, the real thing was, don't rush around, that way you'll get more money for less work. I want to move to my final point by reminding you of two attitudes of Jesus toward thieves. First, his attitude to the swindlers in the temple. Folk on the fiddle. Folk making money out of people's religion. What did he do? He drove them out. I want to compare that with his attitude to the thief on the cross, the repentant thief. Today, you'll be with me in paradise. What's the difference? Simply penitence. So my final section is called Theft's Penitential Face. The thief on the cross knew what he was, and he was sorry for it. Jesus receives him into his kingdom. Zacchaeus is up a tree in our second reading this evening. And he was a tax collector, notorious for overcharging people and pocketing the difference. But he met Jesus, and he met Jesus in repentance, and Jesus sat at his table. The thief had on the cross had no opportunity to put right what he'd done wrong, but Zacchaeus took that opportunity and did it. I was interested in preparing for this to see how throughout the Bible, and I hadn't realized it was such a strong theme before, that restitution is a strong theme and a way of the criminal, the theft, the person who's committed theft, getting right again. I was surprised to discover that in several places in the Old Testament, the thief is exhorted to stop thieving, to give back what is thieved, plus a fifth. Sometimes it's a fifth, sometimes it's another quantity. Here in the Zacchaeus story, of course, he outstrips all that Old Testament provision many times over. But the basic principle is the same. Restore what is not yours to its rightful owner. Whether that means returning books on your shelves that you've had for several years, that you've conveniently forgotten about, or declaring those omissions like I'm going to have to, on my tax return next time round, or somehow reimbursing your expenses that you've taken wrongly, or cutting your lunch hours to the amount in your contract, or paying the company for the times you've put your letters through their franking machine, or whatever it is, restore it. I guarantee if you don't do it in a corner, you'll create some conversations about the Christian faith. Now, that's no reason for doing it. You should do it because that's what God wants you to do. But it might be the way that God brings good out of evil. Restitution. That's one side of the penitential coin. The other side of the penitential coin is what happens after that, which is living contentedly. Let me just quote to you some verses which John the Baptist spoke in reply to various people who came to him. Listen to this. The multitudes asked him, "What then shall we do?" And he answered them, "He who has two coats, let him share with him who has none. And he who has food, let him do likewise." Tax collectors also came to be baptized and said to him, "Teacher, what shall we do?" And he said to them, "Collect no more than is appointed to you." Soldiers also asked him, "And we, what shall we do?" And he said to them, "Rob no one by violence or by false accusation, and be content with your wages." Live contentedly. That, incidentally, if people want to know, is Luke 3:10-14. Live contentedly and share what you have with others. That is the biblical picture. It's easy to say, but in a world of temptation, how difficult to be that honest. But we must do it because that's what God has called us to. Recently, I've been reading Joshua in my quiet times, which is one of the reasons we got that lesson from the Old Testament this evening. The story of Achan. A salutary story, as I said when I read it. But just note the progression of things that happened. Look back sometime on your own at that story of Achan. He says, "I saw, I coveted, I took." I saw, I coveted, I took. And that's what happens to us, isn't it? Time and time again. Simple as that. I saw, I coveted, I took. Pray God that when we see something, whatever it is, we may not covet and we may not take. Someone once showed me, and with this thought I close, someone once showed me how the commandments for us as Christians can become promises. Instead of "you shall not steal," it becomes a promise. "You shall not steal," for the Christian, because God has promised his Holy Spirit to Christians to enable them to live Christ-like lives. "You shall not commit adultery," a promise. "You shall not steal," a promise. "You shall not covet," a promise. Pray God that you'll claim that promise not to steal, that we might indeed honour him in word and in deed. "You shall not steal." Amen.